You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-all-fits branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear, all backed by above-and-beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20, code POD20, for 20% off your first product.
Is it fair to say Keane Lynch is your hurler of the year?
I just say, Keane, here's the trophy. That's it. I wouldn't even give three names. I just say Keane Lynch, hurler of the year. And like, it was all good to give it an extra.
OTB AM, live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Where the football chat flows like Jack Grealish's hair.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now you're very welcome back. So as some transfer sagas are just kicking into gear, others have come to a chastening and brutal end. Happy to say Miguel Delaney of the London Independent is with us. Hey, Miguel.
How are we?
Very well. We have lots to talk about. Let's start with Harry Kane and his tweet. It was incredible to see the reception from the Spurs fans on Sunday and to read some of the messages of support I've had in the last few weeks. I will be staying at Tottenham this summer and will be 100% focused on helping the team achieve success. We'll get into the nuts and bolts in a second of what went on here behind the scenes. Can we pause for a moment on how terrible Harry Kane's PR is and how, frankly, he needs to look at getting new people here? What is the point of the this summer? Like, does Charlie and Harry, do they think this gives them some sort of leverage or a head start on a move with Daniel Levy? Do they think this is like some insert into a contract? It only breeds fan suspicion. I just don't understand what they're at with this summer. Like, it's borderline idiotic.
Yeah, funnily enough, the minute that message came out, an agent actually sent it to me and pointed out those exact two words. What did I mean by this summer? This is like, I mean, talk about any absence of nuance, especially given the situation. I mean, there's a big tangent to this, actually, is that someone else pointed out to me today. Now, again, someone with a vested interest, given they're an agent, in that the two English players that maybe most wanted moves this summer other than Grealish are Harry Kane and, to a lesser extent, Declan Rice. Both have family members among their representation, and neither got the moves they wanted, which maybe speaks to something about the market and that. But, at the same time, tweets like that, yeah, it's even if they get a tweet like that right, we all know Kane wanted to go. It's amazing there's often this double speak in football, isn't there? That we almost accept too readily, where as long as someone does the right thing or is seen to do the right thing, kind of can cover all manner of ills, you know, class, dignity, all the rest of it. But you know, there remains this layer of bullshit on top of the game.
No, it's true.
And a tweet like that sums it up.
Well, it was incredible to see the reception from the Spurs fans. Like, this swayed me. You know, I saw them cheer like they've never cheered before. And look, to be fair, I get that the come down and the climb down is always a bit excruciating, whatever excuse you're going to use. But I mean, to go for the fans' reception, which really just blew my mind. I'd never seen fans cheer like this as the kind of impetus for him to stay, again, is painfully disingenuous. So their efforts at PR are just really average. But so you can't explain to me what they gain, because again, I was at a loss as to why he said I will be staying at Tottenham this summer. Why he didn't just say I will be staying at Tottenham? What do they gain with either Daniel Levy or with the fans or with anyone by saying this summer? What do they even mean?
Well, I suppose you could argue maybe that's one of the most honest things in it, that maybe it's fair enough they did this as it's the reality. The Canes will still want to leave. They'll still want to go next summer. It's just even less likely he will go next summer, as he'll be 29. Hmm. He'll still have 2 years left on his contract, so it's still not a great situation in terms of leverage. But while the potential market remains small, the market for strikers will have gotten much bigger, because, you know, whatever about players who develop in the meantime, that will be a market that will definitely have Erling Haaland up for grabs and possibly Kylian Mbappe up for grabs.
Yeah.
And, you know, a 29-year-old Kane, basically, he's always going to be the third option. especially with that 2-year contract and the price that will bring, against, you know, the two of potentially the next best players in the world. From start to finish, and the start basically being when they signed that that 6-year contract in 2018. This has just been a lesson how not to get a transfer done.
Well, I think Charlie thinks having this summer in the tweet is a clause in the contract now. That's all I can surmise. That's my best guess. So anyway, look, without going overboard in the tweet, distinctly average, but part of this wider botching of this whole scenario. What are you hearing of what went on behind the scenes? It does seem like Daniel Levy did get City very quickly up to maybe 125 million sterling. They weren't prepared to go beyond that. Is that about right?
From my information, and actually, I feel credit should be given. Well, first of all, credit should be given to Sammy Mockbell of Daily Mail today, because he did break the story Kane was going to stay. But a former independent colleague of mine, Jack Pitbrook, has been on top of this, and his reporting has been spot on throughout. And for all the talk of City bids, basically the only official bid that we know went in was one. There was a lot of fairly open discussion about, well, we could give you this, and or trying to send players Spurs away. But the only official bid that went in was a deal that amounted to 75 million straight, and then 25 million on top of that in extra deals, which is obviously well short of what Daniel Levy would have wanted. I mean, I think I myself wrote back in May that Levy wanted close to 200 million. And this was City. It's why I think there's always been a fair question about how much City wanted Kane, because it's not like they ever just went out and went, right, here's a serious offer to make you think. It was always kind of like, oh, well, let's maybe if we can make this done on our terms. It was never going to be on their terms. They're trying to sign a club hero on a 6-year contract in a summer where Daniel Levy just absolutely couldn't afford to give any more or to cede any more ground, given the way the last few months had gone with the Super League and the manager search. So it was just, without a substantial offer from City, it was never going to happen. And there are all sorts of questions why that substantial offer never came in. My hunch would be, and this is some way informed, that they would gladly have taken Kane at the right price, but they didn't want him that much. And some of that actually goes to the way both he and Manchester City play football.
That's interesting, because I was going to maybe pose the question and see what you thought, like the appeal that Jack Grealish has, notwithstanding, beyond just football, which is important to a football club. All that notwithstanding, you suspect Jack Grealish doesn't settle the league in Manchester City's favour. They could cope without a Jack Grealish-type player in their ranks, whereas you would think that Harry Kane, who would most likely score 30 goals in this Manchester City team, pretty much would rubber stamp their claim on the league title this year. So I was wondering if really they had made a mistake. Like, okay, if Daniel Levy's going to do Daniel Levy on this, you say goodbye reluctantly to Jack Grealish for now, and you pay the 160, 170 million for Harry Kane and save yourself 40 million.
Well, yeah, you think so. I think you're absolutely right about Grealish. Now, there are fair arguments that Grealish actually won for 3 years' time to be the successor to kind of De Bruyne and all these players. But right now, he doesn't actually give City an extra, I don't think, because they've got an abundance of players like that. He's just kind of more luxury onto the team rather than filling a hole. Now, Kane would have filled a hole, but sometimes, I mean, parts of this summer have almost reminded me of previous super dominant teams that have made big signings, and you would think, right, that's that done, they've got everything wrapped up now, but for all manner of reasons, it hasn't worked out. I mean, so, United won 3 titles in a row in 2001, bought Varane and Van Nistelrooy. Now, Van Nistelrooy ended up being a very good signing for the club, obviously, and an exceptional signing for the club, but didn't immediately work out in terms of trophies. And that was more down to the balance of the side with Varane. 2006, Chelsea, after 2 titles they dominated, go and sign Shevchenko and Ballack. Seem no-brainers. Again, just disrupts the chemistry of the team. 2008, United signed Berbatov, disrupts the chemistry of that front three. And even with Barcelona, Pep Guardiola's Barcelona, I think David Villa was obviously the fit in 2009, who they eventually got in 2010. But they went for Zlatan in 2009. And again, on a superficial level, it looked like, okay, this is going to make them a better side. But it just caused issues. I mean, and again, another one is actually Ronaldo at Juventus, where even though he's been on a very kind of narrow parameter, given they've won two league titles with him, a success, he's actually caused problems in the way they play football. They ultimately didn't win a title this year, and their progress in terms of trying to play a different approach has been impeded by having Ronaldo there. And I've gone slightly on tangent there, but the point being that as much of an obvious signing as Kane seemed for Spurs, from what I've been told as well, there were little caveats that maybe suggested that this mightn't necessarily have been as super productive as everyone expected. And especially when you've got someone who plays football as specifically as Pep Guardiola plays football. I mean, two of the things that were put to me quite, well, about midway through the saga, when City still hadn't put in that major bid. One was that Kane basically is, I mean, this is something that's been said for years about him, but he's a striker that really sees himself as a playmaker, number 10. And you can see that in the way, and it's necessary for Spurs, that he drops back, links the play, starts playing those balls over the top for Son, all the rest of it. But if he does that with City, he's suddenly getting in the way of De Bruyne, Grealish, all these players, and also not where Guardiola really wants this number 9 signing to be, which is in the box finishing. Secondary to that, one of Kane's great strengths, and this was something that actually Clive Allen taught him to do early in his career when he was not so much having difficulties, but to make him a more complete player, which is that to always finish very early because it takes the keeper by surprise. And that's gradually become one of Kane's great strengths. But, of course, what Guardiola likes, he doesn't like finishing early. He likes build-up play, and ultimately not to take out teams through that, but ultimately to cut them open. And again, how many times have we said it or seen it? That basically classic Guardiola goal where a ball is played across the box or there's a cutback and someone puts it in from 5 yards. So, I mean, now, again, these are relatively minor caveats, but from what I'm led to believe, I think they maybe played a part, as well as Kane's age at 28, into why City didn't ultimately go all in this signing in the way kind of, you know, they have with previous signings, or you often see when managers decide, this is the player I absolutely have to get. City evidently didn't think that Kane was the player they absolutely have to get.
Okay, interesting. Well, he's staying for this summer. Maybe you're right. Maybe there's a degree of honesty about this statement. Although then, it's tied in with the reception of the Spurs fans as some kind of, you know, factor in all this. So it's like, do one or the other. Be totally honest. Treat everyone like grown-ups and say, look, you guys know I want to leave, but I love this club as well, and I'm going to stay for another season. But, you know, me and Daniel have a gentleman's agreement, and, well. So that's Kane. What about this Mbappe situation? Kind of exploded really last night all of a sudden, in official terms anyway, a 160 million offer by Real Madrid to PSG, which Leonardo says, we verbally rejected Real. It's far from what we consider to be sufficient value given what we paid for the same player at 18, especially as part of this amount will go to Monaco. I mean, Leonardo's just worried about Monaco here. He thinks it's not fair on them. 160 million wouldn't be sufficient value for an Mbappe if he had 4 or 5 years to go on a contract. When he has one and he's refusing to sign, then 160 million doesn't seem like an insulting amount.
No, it seems like suddenly very good value, especially if it seems, as Leonardo pretty much admitted, he's going. So you may as well get money for him rather than trying to wring the extra year. And I mean, there are all sorts of discussions here we could have about financial fair play and how Paris Saint-Germain should maybe take the benefit of that signing in that regard. But it doesn't seem to be a concern this summer.
I mean, it would be kind of hilarious if PSG showed that little regard for financial fair play, that they decided to ride this out with. We'll probably get up to a 180 million offer by the end of the deadline. Surely they have to take it, no?
Yeah. But it's interesting, that line that Leonardo put out as well, and it's amazing how transparent he was about this, which I quite like to have to say, because it was something that was said around Spain last night, that Florentino Perez basically, he's put out specific links, because the whole game, it's not to sign Mbappe now, it's basically to secure him for free next summer and show, we wanted you so much that we bid this much when you were still under contract, but with little time left. So it's going to be interesting to see what's next in that regard and whether Madrid do go higher. There are all sorts of questions about how Madrid afford this, or the logic of this, given what's happened in the last year and given basically the open admissions of how bad their finances were amid the Super League. But then I suppose there's a flip side to that as well, is in that that budget may cost Madrid in terms of their general transfer business. But, and this is key to the whole policy of the club over the last two decades, especially under Perez, they're refurbishing the Bernabeu. The cost of that apparently very, very high. But of course, there's a flip side to that, in that they could have this brand new refurbished stadium, and for the first time in their modern history, no real stars to fill it, other than Eden Hazard, you know, kind of slowly jogging around. Whereas you could argue, as much as Madrid are in debt at the moment and for all their financial issues, it actually makes financial sense for a club of that size, and given that Spanish banks will always open credit lines to them for these sort of projects, to get a star in who will fill the stadium, who is Mbappe. I mean, that's the way Madrid have always sold these projects in the past. And you have to say, for a certain level of player, it has worked. And Mbappe is that level of player. And it's what, I mean, I have to say, I was very skeptical about the deal last night, but I was talking to people who are working with the Mbappes on this. And they were, I was surprised by how confident they were that this happens this summer. But that could be just all part of the game. But let's wait and see. I mean, for the moment, I actually, my inkling would be it will happen. But again, it's, I suppose it's all dependent on how much of a game this is.
Lots of games being played. So that brings us finally to Ronaldo. And the reports are he's engineering a move to Man City. You know, it's just kind of a turn up, 36 years of age. Like I was reading, he'd spoken to Bernardo Silva and Diaz and Cancelo about this. His contract expires next summer as well. I mean, it really just shows the last year of your contract is a waste of time, really. Don't read too much into that. I mean, on the face of it, I would have said, well, Pep's not going to take 36-year-old Ronaldo. But then given what you've just said about what he wants from a number nine and how Kane wants to come back and be a playmaker, I mean, if Pep wants someone who's happy to not do much running and to stand up there and score a load of goals, then, well, maybe Ronaldo makes a bit more sense for a year or two.
But even, well, the only thing about that is, I mean, part of Pep's role for a nine is someone that will harry and chase and be up there in two senses, not just to finish.
I retract it then.
Yeah, whereas I'm not sure Ronaldo, I mean, and this is almost a great contradiction of Ronaldo's career at this point, in that he's obviously still an amazing athlete, a brilliant player, one of the best of all time, all the rest of it. And yet, he doesn't really fit modern ways of playing football. And that's one of the issues Juventus have had. Now, there is, of course, a bigger thing to this, which is the geopolitical dimension. Qatar have just signed Messi. So will Abu Dhabi respond with Ronaldo? Because that is something that has been put to me by people behind the scenes. What it ultimately boils down to is Ronaldo wants to leave and Jorge Mendes is investigating what's possible. And I think that their preference is obviously for a super club in the Champions League, but they're not going to go to Spain. Barcelona can't afford them. Madrid, it seems, that's off. Paris Saint-Germain, it seems, is off. Although it would be, I mean, one thing that did strike me last night, one thought, would be maybe Mbappe goes to Madrid and you have Ronaldo and Messi together at Paris Saint-Germain. But
I mean, would it be good or utterly dysfunctional?
I don't think I'd ever want a project to fail more. not for what it represents and everything.
Yeah.
But
you'd be watching every single week.
It would be quite funny. Well, maybe not the league games where they win 7-0, more the Champions League.
And so is Man City a possibility because you're running out of super clubs there?
This does point to kind of, and we've discussed this in the show a lot over the past few years, but this points to the problem football has. I mean, there's more and more money in the game, but most of that money is funneled to the very top end. And it's only created very limited choices for all these players. I mean, if they want to stay competitive and win Champions Leagues and Ballon d'Ors, particularly in their final years like these players, there's only so many clubs they can go to. And it's the same with Conte. Like, it was put to me after some of the reports yesterday that Conte, he doesn't want to go to Arsenal. He wants to go to, his only choices he feels now are Real Madrid, Paris Saint-Germain or Manchester United, depending on what happens next. And it's the same for so many players. And it's not least given the sheer size of football as the one truly global sport. It's such an avoidable shame that it's only really 10 to 12 clubs that can do anything like this. And especially, I mean, like, we're of a similar age, Joe. But, like, I mean, and of course there is a tendency to always romanticise, you know, what the world was like when you were a teenager. But objectively speaking, it was better, say, in the 90s, where you basically had a much wider field of potentially Champions League winning clubs or competitive clubs, where a club like someone like Dynamo Kiev could have a team, a really exciting team that could win the Champions League, or even that more clubs from Spain or Italy who could potentially be vying for Ronaldo signing now, but it's just impossible now because of the way the game has gone.
Well, I think that's very true, and I actually think it feels like a lesser achievement these days when you win the Champions League. I'm more inclined to shrug the shoulders and say, well, I mean, you should really win it. There's only four other teams in it. Whereas, like you said, late 90s in particular, early 2000s, it was a massive thing and there were so many who could win it. That number has dwindled and continues to dwindle.
Yeah, that's exactly it, yeah. And now, again, COVID has obviously made that worse, but it's kind of exacerbated long-term forces that were already there.
Listen, interesting. So that's where we are with all these mega summer transfers, and obviously the window is closing. Miguel Delaney of the London Independent. I know your phone's hopping today. You're busy. So thanks so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Joe. Thank you.
That is Miguel Delaney. This is the football show on Off the Ball. Thanks to Paddy Power for information on responsible gambling. Visit gamblingcare.ie. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Alison Rudd of The Times.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, where the football chat flows like Jack Grealish's hair. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Happy to say Alison Rudd of the London Times is with us. Alison, last time I spoke to you, England were in the throes of Euro 2020. It was all going so well. And, I mean, it ended in quite a memorable night at Wembley for various reasons.
It certainly did. But it's the sort of thing people will happily forget if they're English, I think, Joe.
Look, we want to talk to you about a few things. It's been a really interesting start to the new season, not least with the various London clubs. We'll start with Spurs and Harry Kane and his rather excruciating tweet this afternoon. So, I mean, what a saga. And once again, Daniel Levy gets his way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll be people who study football business writing about this in the PhD dissertations for years to come. It's, first of all, it's a case of how not to run your career as a footballer, because Harry Kane appointed his brother as his agent. And when you're of the stature of someone like Harry Kane, you need an equivalent agent. And I just think keeping it in the family wasn't good enough. Daniel Levy is renowned as the ultimate negotiator. He's done deal after deal, getting squeezing what he wants out of it, whether that be the player staying or the player going at his price. He doesn't like games being played. He doesn't like conversations being made public. So the whole saga was conducted poorly from Harry Kane's point of view. You can't rely on a handshake. The tactic of letting people know there'd been a sort of unwritten agreement that you might be allowed to go, that was never going to work. You don't shame Daniel Levy into doing things. He'll do what's right for the club and for the bottom line. So I suspect what ought to happen is Harry Kane will get a new agent, and we will see. Probably this time next year, we'll be talking, Joe, about him getting a £175 million move to PSG or something.
Various missteps along the way in the Kane camp. And even we were just talking with Miguel Delaney earlier on in the show. Even the tweet today just seems misguided. So, like, there's something very disingenuous about hailing the wonderful reception from the Spurs fans on Sunday as having any kind of effect on his decision. Like, let's be real here. So that's just, you know, kind of patently disingenuous. And then even the "I will be staying at Tottenham this summer," I just don't understand what they gain from that. Like, this does not give them any leverage or any kind of head start in negotiations next year. It just really highlights to the fans that actually I do still want to go. So when the next line says I'm 100% focused on helping the team achieve success, well, that's actually not quite true either. Like, I've no idea why Charlie or Harry or their crack team there said, let's stick in "I will be staying at Tottenham this summer." That'll really show Levy. I mean, it's hard to make sense of this right the way through, very much including this tweet now, which is supposed to settle everything down.
Yeah, I think probably they were overthinking and worrying about what message they wanted to send. I think it's been very important to Kane throughout his Spurs career to have that image of one of their own, and his loyalty, I think, has been part of his brand. He's been praised for it. He likes having that relationship both with the Spurs faithful and with England fans also. I think it probably hurts him quite a lot to think that he might have been left in this horrible no man's land where nobody loved him. So you had people like yourself, Joe, who are analysing it quite critically, and Spurs fans sort of growling at, well, you know, well, he wouldn't be here if he got the money he wanted, he got the move he wanted. So they probably don't feel loved anymore by him. You've got fans of the clubs who might have thought they had the dosh to woo him to their place, to their gaff, feeling a bit like, well, is he ambitious or not? I mean, you do get to a point sometimes with players where they almost become criticised for being too loyal. So he was left in this, I think he's left in a no man's land where he was probably desperate to be loved and to indicate that he's not, he has ownership of what's going on in some way, because they would have guessed that he's not coming out of this very well in a business sense. You don't go public saying you're on your way out and then you stay. You try and paint it differently. But yes, you're absolutely right, Joe. It wasn't done in a clever way, which just underlines my initial point, which is he needs craftier people at the helm of his business. And when you're that important a player, it is a business.
Yes. I know, I feel like Daniel Levy right now is having a cigar saying to somebody, that was just too easy. I mean, come on, make it more interesting for me.
While stroking a cat.
Indeed. So Chelsea-Liverpool this Saturday, I mean, this kind of feels like, an upping of the ante in the Premier League season thus far, in that we'll get to see two very legitimate contenders against each other. So 5:30 on Saturday. I mean, the Chelsea thing is kind of, I'm curious for your thoughts. I sort of the routine at Chelsea where, you know, yet another kind of multilingual millionaire comes in, does his stint and departs, and there's no real sense of a plan beyond that, just to do his 2 years and take his payment. I'd stopped finding Chelsea that interesting once the last of the Mourinho players had kind of departed the scene. With Lampard then, I remember thinking, oh, well, this is kind of interesting and authentic and real, and that didn't work out. He gets the sack and Thomas Tuchel came in, and I was fully ready to go with, my God, Chelsea, this is just such a pointless football club. And then Tuchel, like, against all expectations, completely energises the club. He's a really interesting character, I think. Culminates with the Champions League win. They sign Lukaku now. There's a sense of possibility about the whole thing. I'm really paying attention. I mean, you're covering them. Tuchel just seems like he's been so impressive in the way he's grabbed this kind of, it's hard to call Chelsea a drifting club given that they win so much, but drifting in a sort of corporate sense. And he's made the whole thing very real and relevant again. I don't know how you found covering Chelsea under Tuchel.
Well, you've summed it up to a degree. It is refreshing. But I understand, Jay, why you say you sort of, you know, got a bit dispirited watching them, and you feel like they just bring in a manager then sack a manager. That is actually the exciting and wonderful thing about Chelsea, is that they are ruthless, utterly ruthless when it comes to management. And if anyone had any doubt about that, Frank Lampard, absolutely adored by the fans. They had no compunction about letting him go. You know, another club might have given him a bit longer, given that he helped them out in a difficult transfer embargo time. I let him go. What Chelsea managed to do is that they're ruthless at that point in the hierarchy. But throughout my 27 years of covering Chelsea, at no point have the players lost a sense of camaraderie. So what you have is a club which functions a bit like a small club. They have wonderful family atmosphere that is engendered through lots of different ways, partly through their excellent facilities, but they really go for that. You join Chelsea as a family, and that can withstand the ruthlessness of when they get rid of a manager. And often it's player power that gets rid of a manager, because the owner listens to players. He puts them first. That helps the family atmosphere. And what you have with Tuchel is someone that's come in and he's embraced that sense of camaraderie. He loves it. He calls himself a conductor, like a musical conductor. That's how he sees himself when he's at his best. And he says he's conducting people who are beautiful at their jobs, gifted and fantastic, and make lovely music. And he just makes sure they have the conditions in which to do that. He doesn't try and overcoach or impose too many instructions upon them. He wants them to have freedom. Mm. Players love that. So it's a great symbiosis that he's there at the right time. And I think the ironic thing is he arrived, I don't know if you remember, Jay, but he arrived in London with the tag of being a difficult manager. Yeah. You know, if he didn't get on with the owners, he would say so. He would fight his corner. He'd be prickly. Mm. He'd get cross if they said one thing and didn't do it, or he didn't get the money he wanted. All that's happened is he said, oh, I love it. I love it here. I love dealing with Marina. I love the owner. I love what they're giving me. I feel looked after and I've got a fantastic club. And so everyone's buying into this. I mean, you know, it will peak and it will ebb and sure. He will be axed. But right now it's really working. It
yeah.
really is.
That's really interesting what you say about him seeing himself as a conductor and being a touch hands off or giving the players a certain freedom. I've been under the impression that he was almost the opposite of that, that he was very much, you know, a big details man. And when a side has 19 clean sheets in 30 games, you definitely think of organisation and, you know, a drill sergeant. So that's really kind of an interesting insight into how he sees his role.
But if you do it right, the players won't notice that have those attentions to marginal details. You'll be doing it whilst them thinking that this is cool. We like training. But what he's doing is making sure he looks after the fine detail without the players having to worry too much about it. It's a formula. Mm. And you know, if it clicks, you let it go. You only start really going over finicky if it starts falling apart. And I think also there is a slight disconnect in that if you watch him on the touchline, he's like Basil Fawlty. He's very tall, but he sort of collapses on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, he can get so head in hands angry about one cross not coming off. When you know, any other manager would think, well, that was a good cross. That's promising. If we do that again, I'll be happy. He takes the burden of annoyance and frustration, but he has the ability not to let the players feel hamstrung by that they can still express themselves.
You've been writing about Jorginho as one of the underrated types in this team. I think a lot of people watch Euro 2020 and for the first time really said it to themselves, oh, okay, I see what everybody's kind of raving about here. He really caught the eye for Italy. And do you think he's been underrated this whole time, or has he picked up of late?
I think he's still underrated. I mean, I wrote a piece about him saying, well, he probably won't win the Ballon d'Or, but he's on the shortlist. We should ask why he's on the shortlist and praise the attributes he does have. And so people were going, oh, why are you praising Jorginho? And he's nowhere near a Messi. I'm not saying he is. I'm saying he has other qualities which often get ignored when it comes to the big prizes. There's so much that's impressive about him. His demeanour, for one. I mean, there's a man who smiles under under any circumstances. He must be a great teammate to have. But he's been so adaptable under successive managers at Chelsea. Do not forget, he was booed by Chelsea fans who decided he was Sarri's son. That was his nickname when he joined. And as soon as they fell out of love with Sarri at Chelsea, they decided everything that was wrong with the team was because of Jorginho and his relentless passing that didn't get anywhere, you know, lots and lots of short, and you know, often didn't get you anywhere, but it kept you possession. And then Frank Lampard comes in and says, oh, you know, that people are thinking that he's probably not going to use Jorginho because he doesn't suit Frank Lampard's stated aim, which was to get the ball forward quickly and economically, long balls forward. Immediately, Jorginho does that, changes his style completely, gets the fans to sing his name. And he just sort of morphs into what the manager needs. Mm. And now he doesn't touch the ball hardly at all. He's just, you know, he's intelligent with what he does. So he'll press when it's the right time to press. And he makes sure he offers an outlet to whoever's on the ball. He doesn't feel the need to be a relentless pivot in terms of passing the ball around. But he's always there when it's necessary to be there. And he's not particularly fast, but he's got sort of amazing energy levels. You know, he can keep going and keep going and keep going. And I think managers absolutely adore him. And of course, he's got one of the cutest penalty routines you'll see, that little skip before he scores.
Lukaku looks like this is going to work out just beautifully for all concerned. How do you think he's changed as a player, Alison, if at all, since we last saw him in the Premier League?
Well, one of the things I do like about Lukaku is how open he's been about how he's changed and what he's learned. He's been open about the fact that if he's not particularly happy, he doesn't play as well as he might. He says he's someone who likes to learn from different managers, and he's come back from Italy feeling like he didn't start out liking being a target man. He didn't like having his back to goal. It wasn't something he wanted to do, but he's discovered that it can be a beautiful thing and he can do it really well. And then lo and behold, on his debut, what he does absolutely brilliantly is hold the ball up. I mean, you know, Arsenal, they were warned of the fact that he was going to be good at that because he'd said so himself publicly. But they were like, you know, this is we can't cope with this. He's so good at it. And it gave Chelsea that focal point. I mean, Jorginho was Chelsea's top scorer last season with 7 penalties. Now they've got somebody who could get triple that quite easily. And not only that, but make sure the ball goes wide to their very good crossers of the ball, the very good dribblers of the ball. Mm. And they just looked, I think the whole team looked lighter, happier for him being there. It was like a joy to have him there. And also the other significant thing was I did feel Lukaku himself and the rest of the Chelsea team didn't really need to get into fifth gear. So I think we could see a different Chelsea at Anfield on Saturday where they just give us a bit more.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting game for various reasons. The other London club we wanted to talk to you about was Arsenal, who gave Lukaku such a warm welcome back to Premier League life. So on the evidence of Brentford and then Chelsea, their game against Man City at the weekend has the potential to not be so pretty for them. It feels very grim right now. Okay, so on the upside, they have spent 130 million, so at least the club are investing. Now, this 130 million has been written off by most as has it improved them at all? So Ben White for 50 million. Tavares from Benfica, he came on at the weekend, 8 million. Lukonga played at the weekend for 15 million from Anderlecht. Martin Odegaard from Real Madrid for 35 million. And then Ramsdale in goals from Bournemouth for 30 million. They've definitely paid over the odds in certain instances. The one thing you would have to say is, at least for the first time in a while, there's the beginning of a strategy, i.e. they're going for youth. And it's a step away from, you know, ringing Willian and David Luiz and saying, do you want too much money to come and, you know, play in the short term? That is something. I mean, it's not much, but it's a beginning of something for Arsenal. If we're looking for any kind of small positive, at least it's a strategy.
Yes, I heard in the background behind you, Joe, the scraping of a barrel. I don't know if that was my imagination. I'm not sure if it is a strategy. I think once you've finished outside the European places, you lose that bargaining chip and you do pay over the odds. I don't want to sound too harsh, but Odegaard, he was okay on loan. Mm. I didn't feel, oh, wouldn't it be fantastic if Arsenal were to get him to sign permanently? I mean, he's very smiley and looks very happy to be there, and that's nice. But none of those signings that make me think this is a team that's really going to challenge for the top four. I mean, it's so bad that most people aren't using the phrase top four and Arsenal in the same sentence. They're joking about relegation and the fact that, you know, Ramsdale has a habit of turning up at clubs that go down, and they're a bit of a joke at the moment. It's a very difficult position to be in when you're not offering players European football and you're not, you know, you've got the lure of a big name. It's a big club with a fantastic history. But the manager too, highly respected player, but he hasn't proved anything as a manager really yet. He did come into Arsenal. I was there for his unveiling and I was so impressed by his demeanour and his determination and what he said he hoped to achieve. And he said he was going to get rid of negativity, he was going to get rid of dissenting voices, he was going to make sure it was a team jam-packed with team spirit. People who didn't listen to him, do what he wanted, they would be out. And yet, we seem to have a mixture of players who seem to be trying very hard and others who look a bit confused. If he's planning meticulously for his next opponent, then, well, I'm surprised. If he is, then the players aren't listening, because everyone knew how Brentford would play. They press incredibly high, they're relentless, incredible energy. They look surprised by this Arsenal. They looked like they had not prepared for it. And similarly, they knew what they were going to get with Chelsea and were all over the place. So there's something's not clicking. And I just find it peculiar, given that the Arteta came in knowing there were problems and the problems still exist.
No one is more down in Arsenal than me. You know, I find them an irrelevance really at the best of times. But just in their defence, only Man City took more points than Arsenal after Christmas this year. They took 5 more than Chelsea, 8 more than Leicester, 9 more than Liverpool, 10 more than Spurs. This is from Christmas to the end of last season. And they were top scorers of that group of teams as well. And they conceded the fewest goals too. Now that is impressive. That suggests something there was kind of beginning to work. And I do think we could be reading a touch too much into the opening matches of the season, in that there's been the COVID situation. Brentford on the first day away was always going to be a tricky tie. And, you know, things couldn't go from how they were last season, the second half of last season, to just down the toilet again. Now, do I think they'll get top four? No, absolutely not. Do I think they'll get top six? Probably not. I guess I'm kind of framing this in the context of Arteta seems to be on the verge of getting the sack. Like, that's how bad things seem to have gone. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, that great finish to last season and now these admittedly two very iffy performances, but in the midst of COVID and everything else, I just wonder, you know, on Arteta, are people just disregarding the end to last season because, I don't know, it was strange and it's COVID and there's no crowds and various things? Like, his win percentage is 53, which isn't good, and Emery's was 55, but there was a degree of Arsenal being on the up towards the end of last season, and it just any sense of optimism about that now has just been completely discounted. I wonder if we're being a touch unfair.
Probably. We always are when we talk about football, because emotions get involved, don't they? I don't think we're being that unfair, because it's the same old problems about leadership. We've been talking about what is it about Arsenal and that lack of leadership on the pitch. You know, sometimes you need to win a game that you shouldn't win, but you have the willpower to win it, the arrogance to win it, the togetherness to win it. And when things have gone slightly wrong, they don't necessarily crumble, but they don't look like they've got that it factor of we know who we are and what we're fighting for here. And I think also you're right about it was a bit weird with no fans and COVID and so on. One of the big problems for Arsenal is their home stadium. It's a place where they go very quiet, so you can hear the dissenting voices. There has not been a sense of we don't care what's going on, we're going to support you come what may there. So I did write in a piece, it was like going to the Emirates is like being accidentally opening the door to a marriage guidance counsellor's office, because you can hear people having an argument.
Yeah.
You can hear fans arguing about a player or Arteta or booing a player. You'll always get dissenting voices at a ground, but normally they are drowned out by the ultras or the passionate or the songs. But the Emirates, and then that transmits to the pitch.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be able to hear conversations between between fans sat, you know, 30 feet apart, yelling, you know, when's he getting the sack? But you shouldn't be allowed to. And it can be quite a toxic environment there. And often, I never, ever, ever work this out. Why would you pay for a season ticket, turn up, you know, bother parking your car, you know, 3 miles from the stadium, or getting off at the wrong tube because the one you wanted to get off at is closed and the very expensive pizza en route, and leave at 65 minutes? They do that there. I think there's a contract. If you're a fan, you're a fan. And, you know, you're lumbered with it. You stay with your team. Unless there's something, you know, criminally wrong. You stay with your team, and you might make them better if you cheer them rather than, you know, leave or shout out what you're cross about.
Yeah. God, that sounds grim. That really does. One last point on Arsenal very quickly, like, because I don't even fully believe everything I've just said in their defence. You know, I don't hold out much hope for them. But Danny Murphy, in, I thought, a very fair critique of Arteta, said that, well, look at what Tuchel did at Chelsea, where he arrived first game, identified a formation and pretty much stuck to it and made it work. And Murphy was making the point on TalkSport, I think it was. He was like, at least let's get back to being hard to beat, Arsenal. You know, like he was saying, they've bought Ben White, who plays in a three, who's not good in the air. So put him in a three. And if you want, have Tierney as one wing back, have Saka as the other. That's pretty adventurous and interesting. Get two solid midfielder types. You have an array of them. They're not world beaters, but stick in Partey with a bit of experience and Xhaka just to sit there. And then you've got, you know, some talent with Aubameyang, looked in the mood, in fairness, when he came on, and Lacazette and Smith Rowe, and you've overpaid for Pepe, but, you know, you throw him in there and just at least force teams to beat you, because you couldn't say they made Chelsea really beat them at the weekend. It was far too easy. And Murphy really put that at the door of Arteta. Like, you've got enough there to be more competitive than you are. And his ultimate conclusion was, there is no identity about Arsenal under Arteta. There's no sense of what formation it's going to be, what the personnel will be. It's just a bit of a weak mishmash. And that's kind of the most worrying thing if you're an Arteta fan.
Yes, maybe he has focused too much on the negatives instead of thinking about what's good at the club. I mean, he, even in recent interviews, he's been saying, you know, there are things we don't know, and, you know, maybe he's getting bogged down with the admin. But, you know, Tuchel didn't arrive with a similar CV to Arteta. This is Arteta's first club in charge. And, you know, if you were running a big conglomerate, nothing to do with sport, to do with making computers or whatever, you wouldn't bring in as your CEO someone who'd just been on work experience with Virgin Media down the road. You would, and that's effectively what he is. He's someone with some very good work experience going to a club that he knows, but how well does he know? I mean, he's been at other clubs as well. Yeah. He said, and you know, when he joined, he said he'd wanted to join Arsenal as a player because he admired Wenger so much. And again, Wenger was a long career, someone who plotted a path, who stuck to principles, and you don't do that in the public gaze as your first job.
No,
I mean, and I wish him well, and I as I said, I was very impressed when he joined, and I would have loved it to have worked as an experiment. But you can say all the right things and not necessarily have the skill set to execute them.
No. Well, look, we'll watch the marriage counselling sessions play out over the coming season. Alison Rudd of the London Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, where the football chat flows like Jack Grealish's hair. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now, you're welcome back. Very happy to say Tom English of the BBC in Scotland is with us. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Joe.
Your heart was in Croke Park on Sunday, I suspect.
It was. It absolutely was, yeah. My God, I mean, no matter what sport we cover for the rest of the year, Joe, or maybe for the rest of the millennium, I'm not sure we'll see a performance from a team like that again. Oh. I'm biased, I know, but
no, it's true.
What a performance.
It's getting serious now for the rest of them. We were just remarking on the show that your oldest outfield player is 28, so I don't think this is the end somehow.
Yeah, well, I was listening to your stuff over the last few days, and it was great to listen to. It was great interviews, and they're just hungry, aren't they? Mm. I mean, it's not just everything that they have on the field, it's everything they have in their heads as well. And, you know, okay, they've won another All-Ireland, but they're not sated by it. None of them seem to be. Extraordinary. I mean, I went back and watched it again the other night, because that first half in particular, it was just off the scale. I mean, I'm no hurling expert, but I know greatness when I see it. Mm. And my God, that was greatness.
Yeah, it sure was. So interesting times in Scotland. We have the first Old Firm derby at the weekend on Sunday, midday. We have both Celtic and Rangers in European action on Thursday. And we might start with Celtic. I know Rangers have various issues, including a COVID outbreak. Celtic, though, are feeling pretty good about life. So they're 2-0 up against Alkmaar ahead of the second leg. Post their Champions League exit, Tom, at the hands of FC Midtjylland, things have gone really nicely. I see suddenly Ange Postecoglou has gone from Ange who to fan favourite here. They've had 2 6-0 wins. They've had 6 wins in a row in all competitions. I see pundits queuing up to say how much they like his style of football. I mean, Ange ball I'm seeing now, Tom. So things are going very well.
They are, and it's been kind of out of the blue. I mean, all last season was a horrific experience for Celtic fans. The captain went Scott Brown, the manager went Neil Lennon, the chief executive who was there for 20 years, Peter Lawwell, went. The players didn't come in at the rapidity that the fans wanted. They got dumped out of Europe by a very, very moderate Michelin team. And it was a joke, actually. The way they surrendered that was a joke. Their back four that finished the second leg against Michelin had 2 teenagers, a 21-year-old and a 22-year-old in it. So there was absolute fury there. And a lot of Celtic fans that I know said, right, we're writing off the league. We're writing off the league. There's no way we're winning the league. And all of a sudden, in the relative blink of an eye, it's changed. They've got a few players in. Postecoglou has put his own stamp on it, and he's been very impressive. But I think the guy who's changed it all is Kyogo Furuhashi, the Japanese striker. Mm. He's been incredible. I mean, he's got 6 goals in 7 games. His movement, his intelligence has been fantastic. He's been compared with Shunsuke Nakamura, a great Japanese player of Celtic's past, with Henrik Larsson, the ultimate compliment. And he's brought the best out of those around him. You know, the Ryan Christies, the David Turnbulls, very Tom Rogic's, guys who have been in a slump for quite a while. They look different players now. And I think it's because of him and it's because of Postecoglou's management. He's been very, very strong. He actually called out the board around that Michelin time, called out the board and saying, look, you know, it's my fault. It's my fault that we don't have more players in because clearly my message is not coming across clearly enough. You know, so wow. It was, I mean, he wasn't holding back. Celtic fans loved that. He loved the fact that he's brave. He's a big, tough man, but he likes to play fast, entertaining football. And that's what Celtic fans are seeing. And it's very exciting for them.
I can't say I've seen him a huge amount since he arrived, but I did watch his opening press conference. And he did even then strike me as an assured presence.
Yeah, look, he's been around. Yeah. You know, managed Australia, managed clubs in Australia, managed in Japan, won trophies along the way. And so he's had a pedigree. And, you know, I think the Eddie Howe thing was another problem for Celtic in that they waited so long for Eddie Howe to come in. It was supposedly in the bag. And then Eddie Howe did a fairly swift U-turn and left Celtic in the lurch. And it wasn't so much as, you know, Postecoglou was like, not the special one, but the second one. He came in as like, in a brick glass in case of emergency option. And people were going, God, you know, this guy, who is he? How good is he? But from that, you're right, Joe. From the first press conference, people were going, okay, this fella's not to be messed with for a start because he's tough and he's serious. And there was a little video that Celtic put out of him on the training ground, one of his first training sessions with the players. It's very impressive, the way he carried himself. And every press conference he's done has been impressive. And the signings have been decent. There's one, Carl Starfelt, the centre-half. Still, the jury's very much out on him. But Abada, the right winger, and Kyogo Furuhashi, James McCarthy, obviously, is in as well. He's just signed a Croatian right back, Juranovic, from Legia Warsaw. He looks a good player, played in the Euros. So he's put his stamp on it, Postecoglou, and he's been impressive. It's early days, Joe. You know, they haven't beat much, but they're playing like a team that can really do something. They have a real confidence about them at the moment.
Okay, because I would have thought generally listening to you and others at the end of last season, there would have been a real sense that we're not likely to challenge Rangers for the league next season. This could be a bigger rebuilding project. And actually listening to you now, so would there be a, you know, a kind of a not ridiculous sense now that we're in this with Rangers and we could have a proper title race here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't have said that a few weeks ago. I mean, this is literally kind of dropped out of the sky. So Celtic's improvements have been very rapid and Rangers' problems have come on very, very suddenly. So, I mean, you know, at the end of last season, you had protests outside Celtic's ground. During the summer, you had daily kind of banners going up. At one point, you had a banner which said, shoot the board. Not sack the board, but shoot the board. So the depth of feeling was massive at Celtic. And the kind of despair was massive. So all of that has changed now. It is early days. No, I don't. They are probably getting carried away. But I think they're entitled to get carried away because they had it so miserable for so long last season. And they can see weaknesses in Rangers, which is the other side of the coin. They can see now that Rangers are going through a little of what Celtic went through. Maybe the expectation is telling on Rangers. Maybe the pressure of full stadiums and on all the rest of it. But Rangers are not what they were for most of last season.
Okay, because I was reading about the Rangers' COVID outbreak and it seems Steven Gerrard is one of those who won't be involved tomorrow night in the Europa League. Beyond COVID, there are other issues, are there, with Rangers' performances thus far?
Well, I mean, you know, they knocked out of the Champions League for a start. That was terrible. Malmo knocked them out. And having gone through the entire league season, last season, unbeaten, they lost against Dundee United. 1-0. I mean, they've taken Dundee United to the cleaners in their games last season, but they lost to them 1-0. They've won three in a row since then, but against moderate opposition. So, you know, they won the league by 25 points last season. They scored 105 goals in all domestic competitions, and they only conceded 17. Now they're conceding more goals. They didn't concede a goal for their first eight games last season. Now they're conceding two against Malmo, another two against Malmo in the second leg, two against Ross County. You know, so that defence is making mistakes that they weren't making. They're not looking as steady as they were. And the Ryan Kent, one of their stars, has not done it this season so far. There's talk about maybe one or two of them being transferred out. Are they being unsettled by the transfer talk? So all those things are in play. A lot of that happened to Celtic last season. And looks like history, to an extent, is repeating itself here.
Okay, very interesting. And no great personnel changes in the Rangers camp to explain all this?
No. They haven't really lost anybody that they wanted to keep. They brought in John Lundstrom, middle of the park, from Sheffield United. He's been poor so far. Sent off in his last game in Europe. But all the rest are the same.
Right.
So they will have to sell players because financially, Celtic or Rangers need to sell players. I mean, they are kind of operating on soft loans from very, very loyal directors, but they're losing a lot of money, Rangers. So they need to, and I've said this publicly, that they need to get into a player trading model to become self-sufficient. Now, if they got into the Champions League group stage, they might not have had to sell players because they'd have got, whatever, 30 million plus. But they're going to have to sell players, and they might have to sell some of their bigger players to make the books balance. And that, again, is enthusing the Celtic fans that maybe one or two of the best Rangers players might no longer be around.
And what's Gerrard saying about all this over the last couple of weeks?
He certainly was happier after they beat Ross County. They beat Ross County 4-2 at the weekend. Looked better, should have been a lot more than 4-2. So he was happy with that. Up to that, he was not happy at all and was not afraid to say it. Called out somebody's, not called out individual players, but called out the mentality of the team very honestly, as he has done. You know, he's been there quite a while now. Last season in the league, certainly for them, was great. But before that, they had failures in the league and he didn't shirk it. And he hasn't shirked it in the early weeks of this season. Saying players not looking the same. Ryan Kent, who they really do rely on, is a very, very clever player, quick, elusive. creative. He hasn't done it for them at all, so he has mentioned that. So Gerrard is impressive, but this is a sticky time for him. And with Europe coming up, and he's back in Glasgow, and he's been missing it. Probably the names haven't come out yet, but privacy and all that, but probably missing at least four of his first choice players will not be involved in the European game. They have to get through to that. They have to get through financially and status wise and all the rest of it. And obviously to kind of, you know, to calm supporters' concerns that this is a real slump that they're in. They get through that, then it's on to the Old Firm. You know, we talk about it as the biggest derby game in the world. It's third versus seventh at the moment, Joe. You know, it's the greatest derby in the world. but albeit Celtic and Rangers have played fewer games than some of the ones above them. But whoever, if it's a draw, fine. I'd say they'll both sign for a draw now. Whoever loses that game is going to be under the cosh, particularly if it's Gerrard, because it's at Ibrox and things are a bit tricky there right now.
I wanted to get your take on this story. There was some fans on the way to that most recent Rangers game, and they were racially abusing Kyogo Furuhashi, who you mentioned, who's been playing so well for Celtic, I think, singing certain songs and, you know, making eye gestures to camera and all this kind of stuff. Rangers seem to have come out pretty strongly on this. Have they banned these fans indefinitely? Is it, Tom? Is it for life, pretty much?
Indefinitely. And they have also banned the supporters group. I don't know how many people are in the supporters group, maybe 50, 60, at a guess. But all of them are also banned. So that the guys who weren't on the bus, who are perfectly innocent, they are suffering the consequences of these morons with the racism on the bus. And I thought I'm not sure I've seen that before here. I thought it was very decisive. They were very quick to do it, identified them quickly, banned them quickly. And that's what you want. And I think they have been applauded by a lot of people here, and Celtic and certainly Ange Postecoglou said fair play to them. You know, that's great action to take. But I think Rangers, and they're just sick. They're sick to death of this stuff. You know, they're sick of it. And you felt for Hashi because, you know, he's in the country a wet week.
Yeah.
And he's subjected to this poison. And it hits home. You know, he's obviously seen it. You can't avoid it. But the club has rallied round him brilliantly. I think Scottish football has rallied round to him. A fully formed human being would rally round in these circumstances. But it's sad that a young boy who's in the country for a few weeks has already been hit with this horrible racist stuff. But Rangers have done the right thing here.
Yeah, very decisive, in fairness. And when you say Rangers are sick of this kind of stuff,
Yeah. I mean, they are, and
that suggests like it's an ongoing issue. There's been a litany of incidents like this.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, you know, certain, when I say that, I mean one of their own players, Glenn Kamara, was racially abused on the pitch in Europe last season.
Yeah,
and that was a major ordeal for them. Major ordeal for Kamara, obviously. So that was racism against them, and now some of their own are perpetrating racism against somebody else.
I understand.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, it would have been hypocritical if they hadn't taken action.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I understand. Sorry, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because I saw in their statement, they said, Rangers condemns all forms of racism and discrimination. Those who partake in such behaviour are not representative of our club. And I just thought that's an interesting precipice for Scottish football. Rangers condemns all forms of racism and discrimination. And it just made me think, so where does sectarianism come into this?
Yeah, and that is the other, you know, that's the other strand to this. I have, and some others over here have been critical of Rangers over the years for not doing enough to combat the racism or the sectarianism problem in among sections of their own support. you know, we've seen it routinely, we see it, unfortunately. And they need to step up more than they have done, I would say, in the past. I think they have good intentions. They have a good inclusion campaign going. But they need to match their words with actions on all forms of racism.
Yeah,
they need to be true to their word. And because sectarianism, it's a problem, for sure.
Yeah.
And they need to step up on that front too.
Because it struck me their statement leaves them no room for wiggle room if somebody is caught blatantly abusing opposition players on sectarian grounds. Like, based on that statement, you know, they have to come out and act very strongly. Are Celtic not just as bad and just as reprehensible when it comes to not taking action? Like, would it be generally agreed? I'm probably going to get you into trouble here because, I mean, I'm asking as an outsider, but I would look in as an outsider and think, well, like, is it not like the two of them in it? You know, are Celtic seen as somehow better when it comes to that issue than Rangers?
You're walking me into a burning building, Joe.
Okay.
Ranger Celtic fans will go apoplectic as what they see as false equivalents, as in they're all the same. You know, they're both at it. Celtic fans will say, look, we're a club for social inclusion. Doesn't matter religion, nothing matters. Brother Walfred founded the club, a club for all, and all the rest of them. Their problem is celebration of the IRA, which carries on through various songs that sections of their support sing. The vast majority of Celtic fans are sick to death of listening to this rubbish.
Mm.
The problem is there's a section of supporters who obviously, you know, a lot of Celtic supporters have take great pride, rightly so, in their Irish identity. But the very vocal minority, they express that pride in their Irish heritage solely through republicanism, celebration of republicanism, Bobby Sands, hunger strikers, all the rest of it. They don't seem to my mind, and I've been living here 16, 17 years now, they don't seem to have any or very little grasp on modern Ireland and the problems that modern Ireland faces. They sing endlessly about old Ireland and all of that. And certainly as an Irish person living here, when I hear various songs being sung about, they can sing what they want, I guess. But it certainly kind of leaves me cold.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, going into Celtics, it's supposed to be the kind of, in inverted commas, the Irish club. And you go in here as an Irish person, you feel kind of, oh, this is not a place that I'm particularly comfortable in. When they're singing, when the Green Brigade, they're kind of ultras, if you like, when they're singing a song called Roll of Honor, which celebrating the hunger strikers, and they sing it endlessly, you know, all the time. Most games they sing it. But so that's what you have here. It's very complicated, and you know, it's tit for tat. But I wouldn't say one is worse than the other. I'd say certainly for sectarianism, no question. Rangers, no question.
Right.
Rangers have a big problem there.
Right. Okay. So let's get out of this burning building. But
I think it's too late. I think I've been incinerated.
No, you've inhaled the fumes now. But so the gross generalization. Look, and anyone with the brain is listening. We're having a conversation. It's not meant to offend necessarily. The gross generalization might be then that from the Ranger side of things, there would be sectarian abuse, and from the Celtic side, it's more of a celebration of that IRA aspect of Irishness. That'd be kind of where you might pitch them in to generalize. But that would be how I could perceive it from the outside generally.
And I think a small portion of the Celtic fans would be glorifying the IRA. Small portion,
sure,
but it's a noisy section of the stadium, a noisy section of the away support.
Yes,
but the flip side, the sectarianism on the other side of the city. I think it's not as bad as it was, but it's still there. You still hear the songs. On occasion, you hear them, and And one of the problems here is that the league, Joe, is absolutely spineless. The leadership of the league, the SPFL, will take no action against anybody for anything. Doesn't matter what you're allowed to sing whatever the hell you like in this country.
Right.
Doesn't matter. You can sing about Protestants, you can sing about Catholics, you can sing about people being up to their knees in Fenian blood. You can sing it whatever you like. Carry on, lads. The SPFL have nothing to say about it.
Right.
And I think it's weak leadership. And look, I mean, I know a lot of people over here, obviously, because I've been here for so long. A lot of people say, look, back in the day, it was a gazillion times worse. And I believe that, you know, when there was rampant prejudice against Irish and Catholics in the Central Belt, in Glasgow in particular. I would like to think that that is not gone, but going. But it's still, you know, you still has the capacity to shock, you know. You hear a couple of things, social media is a cesspit. That doesn't help. In fact, it makes it worse. You could go on now and I will find Celtic fans abuse me, calling me a West Brit, which I actually take offence to, you know, as a Limerick man. like somebody from, you know, Uchtar Muchtar telling me that I'm less of an Irishman than they are, you know. And the other side, you'll hear, you know, really kind of insulting talk about your religion and stuff like that. I mean, it's there, Joe. I don't want to make a big deal of it.
No, sure.
But it is there, and I think for generations in the media just washed over this. They just washed over it, and it carried on in football stadiums, and it was never mentioned. And thankfully, I don't know, for the last 20 years or so, it might be longer than that, but 20 years, people have started to talk about it, and it's become an issue. And I think it's good that it's become a talking point, and it does rear its head periodically over the course of the season.
Very interesting. Listen, thanks so much for coming on and explaining all that to us. And, well, I guess we might keep a close eye on the first Old Firm derby of the season this Sunday at midday, and we might be talking to you in the next couple of weeks. Tom English of the BBC. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Joe.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, where the football chat flows like Jack Grealish's hair.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.